On Friday, June 21st, we talked to a former New York City police detective who now teaches at Sacred Heart University. We discussed the ongoing case of a missing Fairfield County mother of five. We checked in with the folks at the Yankee Institute about the latest push for tolls from Governor Ned Lamont. And we wrapped up the show with our weekly check-in from Stratford Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly. Jennifer Dulos' case still rolls on. It's into about a month now. A lot of people, though, are fascinated regarding what exactly police do in a situation, or investigators, or the FBI do in a situation when you are presented with a situation like this. Well, a man who can help us out with this, we hope, has been at Sacred Heart University since 2010. He teaches law and policing courses in the undergraduate and grad programs. Now, prior to coming here to Connecticut, spent 20 years with the NYPD, retired of the rank of lieutenant. His last assignment with the NYPD was in the Detective Bureau in the Bronx. Anthony Papa joins us on WICC. Anthony, Paul Pacelli here. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, Anthony. Good, good. I'm sure you, like thousands of people in the state, have been following this Jennifer Dulos case. And I know you obviously you can't and probably don't want to comment on specifics of this, but I'm fascinated, Anthony, is when police and investigators are faced with a case like this, and there's essentially a clean sheet here, a mother or a person missing, the process that just that kicks off with a situation like this. Cops get a call like this, Anthony. What's the first thing police generally do? Is it to determine whether or not she may be missing on her own volition?
I imagine it would be to see if she's missing on her own volition. But let's first start with it's a missing person case at first. Mm-hmm. That would be the first criminal aspect of it. This is tough because we don't really have a crime scene. After some investigation, from what I read, there was some blood found in the garage and in the kitchen. But up until that point, once there's a homicide, you have a crime scene, you secure the crime scene, and there's certain steps detectives go through in order to gather as much evidence as possible. But when you don't have a specific crime scene, it becomes more difficult, obviously.
So obviously people, you're saying, and that's a good point, you know, I've heard people say, well, they found blood in the garage, and they found blood supposedly on the faucet of her strange husband in the house. But what you're telling us is that doesn't constitute the legal definition of a crime scene.
Not that it doesn't it's not legally a crime scene. It's just that it's a little bit too vague at that point. We're not 100% certain that would be the actual crime scene, because remember, the person is missing. We don't have the body. So the first thing the officers are going to do, the detectives are going to do in a situation like this is the study of victimology. They're going to look at the actions of the victim prior to and up until the point that they were missing. I mean, there's a lot of steps that they can take in order to try to make some kind of determination of whether she left on her own validity, as you said, or if there's some kind of foul play. Did she, you know, interview the friends? Did she work the coworkers? Did she feel threatened by him? And I think from what I read, the court documents, when she filed for divorce 2 years ago, she said she felt threatened by him. Mm-hmm. He spoke of getting pleasure out of arming people, and she felt threatened. So, you know, there's a lot. Then you look at the actions of him. Does he have a criminal history? Mm-hmm. Does he have a violent past? Does he have the propensity? And I think we have the motive here. Yeah. Apparently he owed money to her mother. He was in financial distress, from what I understand, with his business. So, he had a girlfriend,
yeah.
And the motive is there, but the motive, it doesn't need to be proven.
Anthony, when you were talking about establishing a possible motive or looking at the relatives, and obviously, as you mentioned, there was some acrimony here in this case. She said she feared for her life. There was money owed to in-laws here. So looking at all that, are these the kinds of cases where police have told me before is the first person to look at is an ex-spouse or a soon-to-be ex-spouse?
Well, unfortunately, yes. You know, from a from a an investigative perspective, it would be the first person you would look at, especially with such a tumultuous relationship as they have and had. So, you know, that is an issue. But the dots do connect in this case, unfortunately. You know, obviously, I can't speak firsthand. I'm not part of the investigation, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that the police department is not releasing yet because it's an ongoing investigation at this point, such as cell phone records or, you know, the video surveillance or the video footage of him dropping the garbage bags. And maybe they found something and they're not telling us. You know, they want to make sure they have a solid case and DNA evidence before, informing the public and making the arrest for the homicide.
If they, well, obviously, when police approach somebody like, say, her ex-husband in this case, how much, I guess what I'm trying to say here or ask, Anthony, is how much can they push somebody like this? Is it a gradual approach in questioning and talking to him, or do they, do they wait before they try and turn up the pressure here? I would imagine every case is different.
Well, you know, that's going to be controlled by his attorney. I understand that he did plead the fifth in one of his hearings, and you know, he has that right to do that. So that's why they need to gather as much evidence as possible before they seek an arrest warrant. So it puts the officers in the detectives in a difficult position, and the prosecutors, and I'm sure that they're trying to gather as much as possible before. Especially if he's not answering questions, which it sounds like he's not.
So he doesn't, just so we understand here, he doesn't have to say anything in this case until he's arrested, correct? Or am I wrong on that?
Yeah, that's correct. He doesn't. He has that Fifth Amendment privilege right now. He doesn't have to. I mean, I would imagine that he will answer some questions through his attorney, but he did plead the fifth, so he is protected right now.
And he, obviously, his attorney, Norm Pattis, who I do know, I've spoken to a couple of times in the past, Norm's line so far is, and obviously you've probably seen this in the past, Anthony, where, well, my client can, we can account for his whereabouts and the window that's open. You know, this, he couldn't have done this if you look at where he was. So that's kind of a standard defense in this case, right?
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned the cell phone records. A lot of times the cell phone will put the individual at the crime scene when there is a crime scene, because even if they're not using it, obviously if it's on, it's pinging off of a cell tower, and the homicide detectives have been able to make arrests that way. Now, you know, again, there is no specific crime scene other than the garage or the kitchen, but while he was dropping the garbage bags, I'm a little fuzzy on the details there, whether or not he's admitting that he did it. I know they have some video of it, but if he had his cell phone with him, that's certainly something they would look at.
Yeah.
And they did confiscate his cell phone and his car. You know, he can take that car and he could try to wash that car out, but they're pretty thorough. They're going to find out whether or not that car was cleaned out and whether there's any DNA evidence in there.
Yeah, I mean,
they're not going to be able to scrub it entirely clean.
Yeah, this isn't 30 years ago where you could just bleach the whole thing and most of it would be gone. I know you guys can now, and forensics can detect, you know, DNA or even minute amounts of blood with certain chemicals under certain lights. So, yeah, that's not as bad as it used to be.
Right, and there's other evidence that I'm not exactly sure what it means, and I'm sure they have a better grasp on it, such as the box that he threw into the sewer had his license plates, I believe. So I'm not entirely sure what that meant, but yeah, Obviously it meant something if he was trying to discard it. But I'm sure they're doing a very thorough job. They have the state police involved with it, and they're putting all the pieces together, and I'm sure you know, it's something that you just have to be patient with.
Yeah.
I know it's difficult. She's got 5 children. It's a very sad situation, but you just have to be patient and just wait for them to, you know, for the investigation to play out.
Is it fair to say, Anthony, and the guest is Instructor Anthony J. Papa, lawyer, former New York City cop, now teaching criminal justice at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Is it safe to say, Anthony, or maybe not, that in this situation, the police or the prosecutors may be looking at trying to flip his girlfriend here, offering her less of a prison sentence if she can give information here?
I would say that that's spot on. I would think that that is absolutely the next step, especially since they, which I think is a mistake, they gave her a polygraph. She passed the polygraph.
Oh.
And she has some sort of an alibi, but that is good. If she was with him, it's, you know, and she was not a part of the actual incident, the assault that they're claiming took place, then it would probably be very easy to flip her. Mm-hmm. So, and that's definitely something that they would do.
But again, even in this situation, right, they have to be, as you said before, I would think they've kind of got to be gradual in this situation to the point where she might say, at least say to herself, you know, I'm not getting out of this. I'm getting nailed in some way, shape, or form. Is that what they kind of count on here, Anthony?
Sure. Well, I have to see how her mental state is with this. I believe there's been no contact between the two, and that's certainly not beneficial for him. So the police probably have a little bit of an advantage there, the lack of communication between those two, from what I understand. And it's certainly something that they are, if they haven't already, they will work on.
Anthony, there was a couple of stories today and yesterday about some police officials when they were asked about the trash plant search going on in Hartford, that plant off of I-91 there near Brainerd Airport. One of these statements was something to the effect of, well, there's still unknowns in the trash, or, you know, still some sort of information or things that we can get out of that trash. In fact, I think the exact phrase here, there are still unknowns. What do you make of that?
Well, the trash is difficult because I believe they have cadaver dogs working the trash. But don't forget, within the trash, there's other remains, food remains that may, you know, chicken or some other type of animal that's been cooked. So the cadaver may be picking that up, and then the individual investigators have to sort through anything the cadaver picks up. I believe they're putting one cadaver dog in and then sending the second one in sort of as a check from the first one. So it's a difficult, time-consuming task. And they did the right thing. They put everything aside. They got everything they could. Some of the trash hadn't even been picked up. So they were, you know, they were able to isolate as much as possible. But it is going to be a time consuming. If he did chop up the body, you're talking about, well, they need to find bone fragments,
yeah,
some kind of, you know, flesh or something. It could be very difficult when it's mixed in the trash. We all know you throw your trash out.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's
who wants to go? And who wants to go back in there after it's been sitting in 80-degree
right.
weather? You know, geez. Right. And now it's interesting. Cadaver dogs. So you're saying that most cadaver dogs just will light up on any sort of flesh, or can they differentiate between human flesh and animal flesh?
I don't have personal experience with a cadaver mm-hmm. dog, but I would think that, you know, it's not a perfect science. They're good. They're great tools to have. But I would imagine that there could be some false positives out of them, and that's why they're using a backup cadaver dog and then individually going through the garbage afterwards.
Yeah. So obviously then, let's project ahead then, if we can, Anthony. And I know it's difficult, but let's say the way these things tend to sometimes play out, they would have to have, and correct me if I'm wrong, you need enough evidence here, whether it's fragments, whether it's DNA found, to have a judge sign off on an arrest warrant above and beyond the charges he's already facing here to move the case further, correct?
No, I wouldn't say that. Don't, you know?
Oh, really?
I wouldn't say that, because there have been homicide convictions without a body being found.
Hmm.
I'm thinking about one particular case in Manhattan years ago where there was a doctor who killed his wife, and he took the body on his private plane, and they believe that he dumped the body out of the plane over the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And they never recovered the body. But he put himself in that situation by signing the plane out at Teterboro and being in the plane and bringing something out. There were witnesses seeing him bring something into the plane. So that is just, it's circumstantial.
Mm-hmm.
but no DNA. Now, obviously, times have changed since then, and we have a little bit of a problem with the CSI effect, where jurors want to see DNA. When they don't see DNA, it becomes a little more difficult to get a conviction. But I wouldn't say it's impossible, and I would say that even if they didn't get the DNA, if they can connect the rest of the dots, they will be able to make the arrest and possibly a conviction.
Now, finally, Anthony, I want to touch on what you just said, and I hear this from criminologists all the time and from forensics people and cops I've talked to, the CSI effect. A lot of people want this all solved in 48 minutes with DNA, right?
That's true. That is obviously true. Yep. And that's why I was against the I'm from New York. I'm licensed in New York. I've been teaching in Connecticut. My background is all New York. But Connecticut, for some reason, allows the polygraphs. In New York, we don't.
Oh, that's right.
And the polygraph can be beaten.
It's an imperfect science. You have CIA agents that can beat a polygraph. Yeah.
Right. So they use the polygraph on the girlfriend to clear her. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's absolutely true. So that's, then that goes along with the CSI effect.
Great. Hey, listen, Anthony, it's been great. Thank you so much. Anthony Papa.
You're welcome.
He's currently a teacher at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. He's a lawyer. He's a former New York City cop, so you got it all right there. Anthony, we'll talk down the line. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks, Anthony. Appreciate it there. There you go. Anthony Papa, folks, instructor at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. He's a lawyer. He's got that JD after his name, worked as a detective in the Bronx. I'm guessing that as a detective in the Bronx, he probably saw some stuff that is well back in the memory bank to help him look at cases like this and other cases. And he is right. I should have mentioned that earlier. You can get a conviction without a body. And I think the Richard Crafts case here in Connecticut, and that's a famous case from years ago. What went down in criminal history is the wood chipper murder. They surmised that the airline pilot who lived in Fairfield County. Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, Aaron just told me that was the first ever conviction in the state without a body. They surmised that he put his wife's remains through a wood chipper, and they were able to, piece it together, no pun intended, to the jury, and they bought it without a body. And just to set you right for the weekend, just to make the weekend really happy for you, and just to get you off on a great note for friends and family, let's talk about tolls again, shall we? I'm sorry, I can't resist. Mark Fitch is on the phone with us from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. Mark, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir, on this fine Friday?
Hey, I'm doing good, Paul. It's a pleasure to be on. I think this is my first time with you.
All right, yeah. I've had other folks on, so you are being baptized here on Connecticut Today. Yeah. Well, I got the release you folks sent out, and it looks like, I don't know, Mark, I talked to some other legislative leaders earlier this week, and it certainly sounds and looks like the governor and some Democrats are kind of at desperation mode here when it comes to possible votes for tolls here.
I'd say that the governor is in desperation mode. I don't see the same from the Democrats. So, I was at the governor's press conference Wednesday after he met with legislative leaders.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing to note is, the governor came out and talked to the press. The Republicans came out and talked to the press. House Majority Leader Matthew Ritter walked out and just left. So it felt like there was some kind of symbolism in that.
Mark, if I could just jump in here, I think the symbolism here is Matt Ritter and some of these legislators, they saw that poll that came out a couple of weeks ago that said 60% of people in the state don't want tolls.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the same number that came out before, and this is after a $1 million, publicity campaign done by, a pro-tolls group. And this is after the governor has been all over the state standing under bridges and, telling people that they need tolls. So there's clearly the public is not happy with this idea. And clearly the governor and the government has not been able to move the needle in any direction on it. So right now it's kind of at a standstill.
Mark, do me a favor. If you see the governor at any one of these gatherings, send him a message from me, seriously, saying, listen, not for nothing, Governor, but you're not going to sell tolls with cheaper bus fares. Okay, that I read that, Mark, and I say, well, but it doesn't make any sense. The people who generally, I know people have different situations in life, Mark, but generally the people that you want to appeal to for tolls generally aren't taking the bus. And the people that take the bus, Mark, on a daily basis, living in urban areas, they generally won't be affected by tolls. Am I missing something here?
No, you're spot on, and it just kind of adds to, there's been this narrative throughout the entire legislative session where it's like, if we get tolls, we're going to build better trains and we're going to have lower bus fare and things like that. And I'm like, no, you're not going to be able to do a lot of those things. And you know, all those things that they talk about doing, and we're going to have better trains and stuff like that. That is, so you have a bunch of drivers paying so that people can ride the bus or ride the train for cheaper. And that doesn't really appeal to the people who are going to be paying the bills by driving to work every day.
No, it doesn't. And the thing, and I had Len Fasano on yesterday and a few other legislators on last week, and, you know, Mark, the thing that scares me, that really actually scares me, is when I see the term or the words congestion or congestion pricing on any of these proposals. Now, number one, you and I both know, the Turnpike and the Merritt are always congested. How about non-congestion? And number two, I'm frightened, Mark, that people don't understand what that is. When you see or hear congestion pricing, that's a fancy Latin for charging you more in the morning and afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. So the price is variable. It goes up during peak periods. And it goes down during, you know, times, at, you know, 2 a.m. or something. If you're driving around, it's not that congested and you don't pay as much. And here's the thing. Those toll rates, you know, the governor runs around trying to sell it as, oh, it's only going to be 4.5 cents a mile. Okay, for the first 3 years, according to the bill. And then after that, they can raise the rates. So you don't know what that toll bill is going to be, you know, 3 years from now. They have a moratorium on it in this particular iteration of the bill. But after that, sky's the limit. And if the whole goal is to drive, is to get people off the highways, well, you have to make the price painful enough to make them get off the highways or take other forms of transportation.
And really, so, really, Mark, how many people, honestly, and I floated this on my show yesterday, how many people honestly can get off the highways or get off the rolls? They have to go to school. They have to go to work. The school and the work locations, 99% of them aren't near a Metro North line or a CT rail line or a bus line. And it's just, it boggles my mind, Mark, how scattershot this whole thing is.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is people don't get the option to go to work at different times just because they're tolls, you know? So I still have to get to work by, you know, 8:30 in the morning, so I'm going to have to drive at the same time. I mean, I can try to take back roads, it ends up taking more time, and I end up crowding these back roads, and you kind of end up with the same problems at the local level rather than on the highway. And the other thing is people, you know, the powers that be sit there and say, oh, well, you know, you can plan your trips around the toll price. Yeah, because that's how I want to spend my life.
Honey, let's go out for that nice romantic dinner tonight. But we have to go out after 10 o'clock when the tolls go down.
Exactly. You know. So you're right. You know, the landscape of Connecticut, the way that the state is set up, it's not like other states. We don't have, you know, the mass transit can't get everybody where they want to be. And largely in other states, mass transit works for major cities. I mean, not the entire state. So we need to, you know, and people are taking interstates to work because those are the main arteries going through the state. So, yeah, I mean, we have a situation with the Special Transportation Fund, but that doesn't mean that, you know, tolls are necessarily the answer, or that tolls could even be accomplished in such a way to raise the money that they need.
Mark Fitch is the guest from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Also, Mark, you probably noticed this week the other pitch was, or the other sweetener was, I love using that word, the other sweetener was that, okay, well, if you go for this, then we're going to drop the income tax rate on your first $10,000 of taxable income in the state, which would save people at the most about $180. You saw that one, right?
Oh yeah, I was there when the governor announced that, and this is just one more of his attempts to strike some kind of deal with not only the Republicans, but with the public. So we have lower bus fares. We have, in the bill, there's a chance that the gasoline tax could be lowered by 5 cents. There's an attempted payoff to Bridgeport in the form of a new train station. And now we have a tax credit that adds up to about $100 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you're done doing all these things, I'm wondering if you're going to have any toll revenue left. And then factor in having to build the things and operate them and everything like that. So, yeah, and this has been ongoing. And let's not forget, the governor's kind of faux pas when he went into the Democratic caucus room and told them that he was going to raise money for them if they voted for tolls.
Hello?
Yeah.
Is that a bribe or what? What is that? Jeez.
That definitely raised some eyebrows. It didn't put the Democrats in a good position.
No.
And I think at this point, after, it was a long session, it was a tough session with a lot of ups and downs and twists and all that kind of stuff. Right now, it seems like everybody's just feeling kind of done.
Yeah.
And aren't exactly enthusiastic about rushing back to the Capitol to take a vote that most of the state is going to hate. So.
And Mark, whatever happens with this toll situation, because of what you people do and folks like Patrick Sasser and No Toll CT, Mark, just when people like me who do shows like this, just when I lean back and say, that's it, we're screwed, we can't stop this stuff, you know what? It does come to a point, and this is the first time, Mark, really since the income tax in the early 90s, where a lot of this state, more than I think registered Democrats, have come up and said, listen, no, no, no. That's at least a little heartening.
Yeah, and this is obviously coming after, several years of tax increases over and over again, and we end up with the same deficits over and over again, and people are tired. People are moving out, and we're seeing our friends and neighbors move out, and we don't want that anymore. And so when the people of Connecticut hear about a plan to, toll every mile of the interstates, people are going to finally sit there and say, that's enough. I don't think we need to do this. And seeing the rise of No Toll CT, that was impressive. I mean, that, I remember seeing them when they first started the previous year under Dan Malloy.
Yeah.
And they've really come into their own this year. So it's great seeing that kind of grassroots, activism and uprising. And they've been doing some great work and really holding the lawmakers' feet to the fire, because they're out there doing it all the time.
Yeah, and what's sad about this whole thing, Mark, really, is that I talk to people who say this, and frankly, I say it too on this show. I said, listen, if you can convince me that the money you are asking me to pay is actually going to go to do what you say it's going to do, and it's going to be done conscientiously, maybe you can sell me on it. But Mark, the bottom line is fewer and fewer people have trust in our lawmakers, and they don't trust the General Assembly. They just don't.
Well, here's the thing. When they sit there and they say, we need the money for infrastructure, my first question is, well, what happened to all the other money that you've been given over the past 20 years?
We have a transportation fund. We have a transportation. We have a transportation fund.
Yeah. What's happening to it? Melissa McCaw, the Secretary of OPM, said that what's going on with the Special Transportation Fund is that, the expenses are outgrowing the revenues. So expenses are growing by 6% every year. Revenues only growing by 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's not going to last. That's not going to work for very long. But at the same time, the budget underfunds that transportation fund. So they're taking $172 million out of it, by diverting the vehicle sales tax revenue,
mm-hmm.
and then sitting there saying we have a problem that we need to fix now. Well, you could help. You could, if it's so important that this transportation fund be, have a lot of money in it and all those kind of things, why are you taking hundreds of millions of dollars out of it? And that's a question that a lot of people have. The Lamont administration did not help himself when he sat there and said, I need tolls, and then wants to divert all this money away from the transportation fund. it's just not a good, it's not good politics. It was not a good look.
No.
The public knows it, and he's kind of paying the price.
Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Mark, thank you. We'll be in touch. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Paul. Anytime.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Mark Fitch there. All right. Let us see what's going on at the state capitol. And joining us right now, Stratford Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly on the line. Kevin, you survived another week. How are you?
I did survive another week. I'm doing well. And it's always tough to follow Dr. Schifo and Diane Auger. St. Vincent's does so much for our community in providing good quality health care services. But also these added benefits, like you were just talking about, for people that might be uninsured. They do a lot of fundraising to help people in need. And it's why we need hospitals and nonprofits in our community. And all too often under the dome in Hartford, they turn their back and actually look at them as people that or in institutions not to cooperate with. It's something that I can't figure out, but I certainly support all their efforts because you see the impact it can make in people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, think about if the nonprofits, and whether they're hospitals or churches or social services on either part of the aisle, I mean, think about if those people like the folks at St. Vincent's and other organizations, think about if they weren't around, the additional burden that would be placed on the state government.
Exactly. I mean, and it demonstrates that government doesn't have all the answers and isn't the end-all and be-all, that there are people and entities that do care and can provide better quality services than the government can, and we should be supporting those. And, you know, St. Vincent's is a perfect example.
Well, Kevin, let's go to some dollar and cent stuff, as we usually do at this time on a Friday. We had the governor renew his pitch the other day for tolls, and I know he took the leadership of both parties in, and according to what Senator Fasano told me, let loose with a big PowerPoint there. But the fact remains, Kevin, is it certainly sounds like they are still searching for votes here.
Exactly. I mean, what it demonstrates is the failed leadership of Governor Lamont. I mean, after a two-hour PowerPoint presentation where he articulates a problem with our transportation system and that there are issues of safety, he, on the same hand, drained the special transportation fund. So rather than recognizing the problems the citizens of Connecticut face, he drains it, you know, which makes the problem worse. And then invites the Republicans in, and, you know, Len Fasano said it best. You know, we haven't been in the room on anything he's needed because he has all the votes. He controls a majority substantially in both houses. He's the governor. They're all from the same party. But he called the Republicans in to show that he had nothing but a pair of deuces when it comes to tolls. And the people of Connecticut don't want it. The numbers don't add up. He says we need $725 million for transportation. Taxpayers make a $1.9 billion sacrifice to the special transportation fund that he drained. So the money was there. He just didn't exercise the right leadership to put the money into transportation, and now is coming back to the taxpayers saying, you have to pony up more. To me, that's just failed leadership.
Kevin, what is your response to his OPM secretary who says, well, we need this because the money that we do put in the special transportation fund, the growth of the needs of the fund far outpaces the money we can put in there. What's your answer to that?
Well, first things first, let's honor the sacrifice taxpayers do make. There's $1.9 billion, that's with a B, that's being done through gas taxes and DMV fees. There's another $550 million coming out of Washington. That's $2.4 billion. Let's start there. If we need this and it's so important, why isn't it being used for transportation today? Why are they draining that and allocating it elsewhere? And that's why taxpayers get upset with what happens in Hartford, and particularly with the Democrat administration in Hartford. I think it's failed leadership. If this is such a critical issue, it should have been the first dollar spent on transportation. That sacrifice has been made. Let's honor the taxpayer's sacrifice. Let's put it where we said it was going to go. And then if that $1.9 billion doesn't go far enough, then we can revisit the issue. But until then, I think it's just it's fool's gold is what it is. It's a flawed argument when you've squandered $1.9 billion.
You know, Kevin, you brought up something there that's interesting. I want you to go back on. A lot of people don't realize that we get a significant amount of federal highway transportation money. You quoted it as just being a little over a half a billion dollars here. Now, what happens to that money if we jam tolls through here? This is all interconnected, isn't it?
Well, it is all interconnected. And, you know, when we talk about the federal money, we have $300 million in taxes of federal dollars that are sent to Washington, and we get $550 million back. So it's an extra $250 million. When you use the governor's own numbers, he's looking at, with tolls, trying to get $720, $25 million from revenue off tolls. And the purpose there was to catch out-of-state users of our highways. Molloy and the DOT did studies that showed about one-third of tolls will be paid by out-of-staters. So that's, you know, roughly $200 to $250 million, which we are already getting from Washington. So the fact is, we out-of-staters are helping Connecticut, but if we put tolls up like we had back in the 80s, we run the risk of losing that money. So once again, it's a burden we're going to put on Connecticut residents that are already financially strapped by the poor economy, quite frankly, created by Dan Molloy and the Democrats, now being perpetuated by Governor Lamont. And it's just a fallacy, and the numbers don't work when you really look at it, and it's a push at best. The only difference is Connecticut taxpayers are going to pay more.
All right, and one other thing, Kevin, quickly, in about the minute we have left, I know that we're still waiting to see, and they say the talks are ongoing, but I know the governor's budget technically, supposedly, sort of balances on $450 million worth of concessions. Got about 30 seconds here, Kevin. Concessions from the state unions. Any rumble that this is making any progress or not?
I haven't heard very much in that regard. I mean, it is a budget that is expecting $450 million in savings, but that's a hope and a prayer because it hasn't been negotiated out. They haven't agreed to it. And Governor Molloy, when he was governor, he came to the legislature and asked for approval and also put in the budget. If he didn't get that, he had an alternative already set up so that it was constitutionally balanced. This budget is not constitutionally balanced because he didn't do what he was supposed to do, and it's just another example of the failed leadership of Governor Lamont.